horrible experience. I went here with a group of six, including my parents. And despite our reservation, we had to wait 20 minutes for a table that was empty when we walked in. My father was in the unlucky seat with his back to the kitchen and ended up with a bowl of soy sauce down his back, coat, hat, umbrella, thanks to a clumsy waiter who giggled at his mistake with an insincere apology. Our food was subpar for such a highly rated restaurant. Overcooked fish, undercooked noodles, and one dish that wasn't labeled as spicy was so hot that my father refused to eat it. I won't be going back to this particular P.F. Chang's.
Broadway actor Greg Hildreth from the video series Real Actors Read Yelp. Now, one angry customer dumping on P.F. Chang's isn't likely to sink the restaurant chain, but for smaller businesses, a negative Yelp review can cause some real damage. And for years, small businesses have complained that Yelp manipulates their reviews. They say it calls and asks them to pay for advertising on the site, and if they decline, they say the website takes away good reviews and moves the bad ones to the top of the list. A group of businesses filed a class action lawsuit against Yelp, but yesterday a three-judge panel of the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco came down on Yelp's side. Rolf Winkler is a tech reporter in San Francisco for the Wall Street Journal, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, what did the decision say yesterday?
Well, the decision was interesting because, in effect, the plaintiffs were saying they were being extorted by Yelp. They're saying that Yelp basically, their salesman, okay, backing up for a minute, the way Yelp makes its money is it gets small businesses to advertise on its site. And to convince them to advertise on its site, the small businesses claim that Yelp salesmen would come in and say, hey, you should buy advertising. And when they politely decline, suddenly positive reviews somehow magically disappear from their page. Other businesses have alleged negative reviews get posted on their page. And they say these are hardball tactics. They allege extortionate tactics in order to sell advertising. But the ruling disagreed.
And so why did they disagree? Did they say there was no evidence that this was happening?
Well, it's actually kind of complicated, but fascinating in a way. They didn't really, the ruling didn't really speak to whether or not this was happening. It spoke a lot of allegations. But the key thing was that it said that in order to demonstrate, in order to claim economic extortion under federal law, you have to show that the defendant, in this case Yelp, had no right to seek payment for the service offered. Now, what does that mean? That's legalese. The point that when you boil it down, what it really means is small businesses don't own their Yelp page. They have no right to have positive reviews show up on that page. That's Yelp's page. There's a review for that restaurant, for that P.F. Chang's we heard about. There's a review on Yelp whether P.F. Chang's wants it there or not. Yelp owns it. So it's not really the right of that P.F. Chang's to have those reviews appear there in any way that they want them to appear.
So it wasn't a sort of pay-to-play scenario. That's not what the court found.
Well, the court almost found that it doesn't matter, that Yelp absolutely can claim to can expect to be paid for services that could be thought of as useful. In this case, a website that lots and lots of people use and they go to find small business listings, that's a benefit that Yelp provides. And therefore, in a sense, that the court basically said, sure, Yelp can ask for money for that service.
And so what was Yelp's response to the claims made by the businesses? Essentially the same thing?
Yelp says that they don't do this. Yelp says they don't manipulate the reviews in order to sell advertising. They say there's no evidence of that. They say that their reviews are filtered by an algorithm, by a computer. Now, I'll tell you, as a journalist who's written about Yelp in the past, pretty much every time you write a story, a small merchant or two will email you out of the blue with complaints about Yelp. And some of them sound pretty compelling. One small business in San Francisco emailed me and said, you know, we had a 5-star rating, lots of great reviews on Yelp. Salesman came in, said we should buy advertising. We politely declined. And next day, a lot of our reviews magically disappeared. Coincidence? Maybe.
Okay, so hang on. I'm going to bring in one of those small businesses, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, John Mercurio, owner of Wheel Techniques, an auto body shop in Santa Clara. Welcome.
Hi.
So is that what happened to you?
same exact thing.
Can you describe it?
We were printing out the whole form on once a week and to show our customers and put it out front. And when we were printing it, there was a 5-star on top and there was a 1-star right below it. And after we printed, the salesman called right as we were printing it, and we denied charges. I got on the phone. I said, no, I don't want to advertise with you guys. And we had the computer still on, and within 5 minutes, they took off that 5-star, and the 1-star went right to the top.
So obviously you don't think that's a coincidence?
Not. Almost impossible. And this has happened. This is constantly happening to me all the time.
So how has that affected your business?
It brought me down about 30% of my revenue in those years. I do have a graph, too, for I've been in business 29 years, and it's showing that that definitely, once Yelp started doing that to me, it definitely damaged my business.
So what do you make of what the court said, that basically you don't own the Yelp page?
Yeah.
And, you know, too bad.
I'm disgusted. I can't believe that this company can get away with this. It's horrifying. It's just, it does stuff to a business owner after working so hard. He has absolutely no control. He's a hostage to Yelp. You have to pay advertising or you die, basically. It's almost like the mafia of the internet. It's crazy. It's just crazy.
So Yelp says it doesn't do this at all. Have you talked directly with them and complained about this?
They haven't talked to me ever since I've been in the lawsuit. They won't return my calls. I email them. They won't say anything after this all happened.
What about fighting fire with fire and getting a bunch of your friends and family to post positive reviews?
We tried 2 reviews one time, and they took them off immediately. Just to see what would happen, and they did take them off. But I don't believe in that. If you look at all my other ratings, I have Google 5 stars with 19 5-star reviews. Yellow Page, I have 95 5-star reviews out of 95. Same with City Search. And it's just amazing that Yelp has all this. You know, I have 3 stars on Yelp now. And there's a lot of reviews on there that not even customers of mine. It looks like they're putting them on or somebody's putting them on. I have absolutely no control of what's going on with that.
Oh, so you think they're actually writing bad reviews?
I've heard that through the grapevine with the people that have worked there, had roommates that worked there. I personally think it's happening.
I have to note that we asked Yelp to come on the program today, and they declined our invitation. And I want to go back to Rolf Winkler, Wall Street Journal tech reporter. Have you heard that, too, that Yelp actually writes bad reviews to businesses who don't pay their advertising?
I have not. I mean, that's certainly alleged in this lawsuit. I think it's tricky to find proof. There's a lot of hearsay evidence. I don't think anyone's ever actually demonstrated that this is happening. But, you know, a lot of coincidental occurrences. One thing to keep in mind, though, Mr. Mercurio mentioned when you ask, you know, fight fire with fire, have people put positive reviews, friends and family on your page. But that's something Yelp also has to fight against, right? Because at the end of the day, Yelp is there not to serve small businesses. Yelp is there for users, right? Yelp needs to provide accurate reviews for the people that are going to the website. It's not primarily a place for the small business to promote itself. So if small businesses are, in effect, stuffing positive reviews into their pages, that's something Yelp would have to remove, just like, you know, a negative review that may be invented from a non-customer.
Well, yeah, and that is certainly something we've heard about, that Yelp has tried to weed out these fake reviews. So why is it that Yelp is the biggest player in this? Why isn't there another similar company that has come up to take it on and maybe engage in other business practices that businesses and customers would find more trustworthy?
Well, I guess you'd have to say that Yelp must be doing a decent job. People, customers, users must feel that those reviews are accurate relative to the other places that they can find reviews, or they're just so accustomed to using Yelp that they haven't noticed a difference in order to need to go anywhere else. There are competitors. Google is one. Google is trying very hard to promote its own local results, even over sites like Yelp, and it also collects reviews. So that is another place that users can go.
Well, in general, as a user, should we just take all those reviews with a big, huge grain of salt?
Perhaps. I know I've had mixed experiences myself Sometimes they can be very accurate. Other times, you know, you'll go to a restaurant, somebody has said, you know, try that dish, and the dish turns out to be terrible.
Right.
But that's tricky. I mean, any algorithm that Yelp is going to build, they say that, of course, it's the algorithm that determines which reviews get posted and which get removed. Any algorithm is going to be, it's going to be difficult to spot, you know, the good reviews, the bad reviews, the ones that need to be removed, the ones that have been falsified in some way. It's a difficult process.
And John Mercurio, just really quickly, what do you do now?
I own my own business still.
I mean, in terms of the lawsuit.
What am I going to do now? Mm-hmm. There's really nothing I can do.
So that's the final word.
I've been bearing down with it. I'm going to go try to do something else. I mean, everything we've tried to sue them for what they're doing with the extortion and everything, they get away with it.
All right. John Mercurio owns Wheel Techniques in Santa Clara. Rolf Winkler, tech reporter in San Francisco for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. Have you ever been burned by a Yelp review? Or if you're a Yelp user, does any of this change your mind about the site? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can join the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, why one football fan decided to call it quits and stop watching NFL games. He says he could no longer justify watching a sport that thrives on high levels of violence. That's next on Press Play.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, a giant seabird and a big block of cheese fought it out last night on NBC. The bird ate the cheese. The Seattle Seahawks beat the Green Bay Packers 36-16. But there was one NFL fan who was not watching, nor will he be watching this Sunday when a lot of football teams will hit the turf. Steve Allman's new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. And he's here now. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
So I guess you have a lot of free time on your hands now.
I do, but I have three small children and debts no honest man can pay, so I do not have that much free time, it turns out.
Okay, so your manifesto is quite serious, and it goes over the things that we've heard a lot about in the last few years about the concussion crisis in pro football, for example, the domestic violence problems with pro athletes, the culture of homophobia that's emerged recently. So what was the one thing that put you over the edge?
Well, it wasn't one thing. I got to be honest with you. I mean, it was a series of realizations and kind of an evolution. You know, so for instance, I wrote a review of the wonderful writer Michael Lewis's book, The Blind Side, you know, probably 5 years ago or whenever it came out, several years ago. And on the one hand, that's this inspirational story of this African-American kid who makes it to college in the NFL, and he's sort of taken in by this rich white couple. And but on the other hand, it's a story of racial exploitation, and the kid poses this question in the middle of the book that is basically, why did you rescue me? What is the nature of your interest in me? If I was just a poor kid of color who was going to flip hamburgers at McDonald's my whole life, would you have taken me in and spent all this time and energy and love on me? And I think everybody who's honest with themselves knows the answer to that. And I think the thing that was sort of the watershed for me was I got a call last summer, and my brother was calling to say that my mom had suffered a fall and needed to get out to California. I'm in Boston. I flew across the country. It was just after the birth of my third child, so I was already pretty addled. And when I got to intensive care, my mom was gone. And this is a Yale-educated, one of the smartest people I know, doctor. And you know, overnight, literally overnight, she had lost her cognitive function. It was an acute dementia, and she's since recovered. But you cannot encounter somebody whose brain is gone, and therefore their identity is gone, who you love, and continue with the abstraction and the excuse that, well, you know, the players choose to play, they get paid a lot of money, all the excuses that fans make in order to allied what the real issue is, which is we consume a game that is so violent that the end product for a significant percentage of the players is dementia. Mm. Once you've seen that up close in someone you love, the story of Mike Webster or Junior Seau or whoever it is no longer abstract. It's a real thing. You have a real moral responsibility.
A moral responsibility. A moral responsibility to not watch?
Let's put it this way, Madeline. By watching, you are actually a sponsor. The NFL doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists because the fans have said that this form of entertainment is so wildly important to us that we are going to give it all this time and attention and money. It's a $10 billion a year industry, and Roger Goodell would like it to be a $25 billion a year industry. And we built that. Without us, without all the cheeseheads and Seahawks fans and Oakland Raiders fans like I was for 40 years, the NFL doesn't exist. We're the ones actually in charge. And all the news stories that we hear about the NFL, even the ones that appear to be taking this sort of high-handed morality role about Ray Rice or this player's malfeasance or that owner's greed, are really an attempt to just look at an apple and say, boy, that apple has a worm in it, and not consider that the entire orchard of our fandom when it comes to football is corrupt.
Is it more corrupt than any other sport?
I would say more corrupt. It's the most popular sport. It's the most profitable sport. And it is also a sport that is profoundly violent, and it's a collision sport in a way that people always say, this is another one of the excuses or rationalizations in a little suitcase of rationalizations that football fans carry around. And I know I have my own suitcase of rationalizations I carried around for 40 years. I'm no better than anyone else. But this is what I hear from a lot of folks and what I used to say. What about hockey? What about boxing? Well, hockey's much less popular. And in hockey, there are big hits, and there's something even more savage, which is sanctioned fighting, which is brutal and barbaric. But it's ultimately, those are things that take place outside the normal flow of the game. They're an exception to the rule. Football is actually a collision sport. There are hundreds of collisions on every play, or let's say dozens of collisions on every play at the line of scrimmage, in the secondary, everywhere. That's by intention. That's what football is. And it's not the big, huge, catastrophic hits that cause concussions that are really dangerous. Medical researchers now know that it's the slow and steady buildup of these subconcussive hits that leads to these brain trauma illnesses just as much or even more so than the catastrophic hits. You can't take that out of the game because it is woven into the fabric of the game, and it is the reason why we have parabolic mics on the sidelines to capture every bone-crunching decibel. It's the reason that we have endless replays of the most violent plays, and that you hear a crowd instinctually react by going, ooh, when there's a big hit. That is us, the fans, consuming violence as a form of entertainment. And it's not fake violence, it's real violence.
Steve Almond is joining me now. His new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Of course, as you well know, as a reluctant fan, now I guess you're a reluctant fan or just maybe not a fan at all. I don't know.
How about just tortured fan?
Tortured fan. There are a lot of fans out there that, for a lot of people, football is an incredible thing. It is something that they love to watch, you know, not just to see the violence, but for the beauty of the game and for
sure,
the art of it and its complexities and for the drama. I mean, this is classic drama played out live every week on our screens, and it's irresistible for many of us. And this is something that, as you have talked about, facilitates community and bonding amongst your friends and your neighbors. And so there's something valuable to that.
Absolutely. That's part of the difficulty of morally interrogating our pleasures. Bacon tastes good. It is yummy. We don't want to see the slaughterhouse, but it is absolutely delicious. And football is absolutely delicious. And I don't mean that in a condescending way. I've been a fan, a hardcore fan, for 40 years. I really love the game, and I spend a couple of chapters in the book trying to talk about the nature of fandom, what has made football so incredible, the way in which it combines a certain kind of primal aggression, but also a reconnection to the intuitive joys of childhood, running, leaping, catching the ball, the narrative possibilities, the strategic density of the game, along with those miraculous moments when we see a Barry Sanders make just the right cut at just the right moment and break into the open field and head towards the end zone. It's incredibly stirring. But when you're an adult, you realize that there are certain things, whether it's football or religion or our own patterns of like what we eat or what we decide to drink, that are complicated. They make us feel good, but they also are in some ways bad for us. I think it's wrong that our communities, our cities, whether it's Detroit or St. Louis or Baltimore, are actually paying hundreds of millions of dollars to help build stadiums for billionaire owners and not seeing a return on those investments. And
so what you're saying is football can't be fixed. We can't make it safer. We can't make it less greedy. We can't, you know, in other words, get rid of the tax-exempt status for the NFL or not give tax breaks to billionaire stadium owners, make the hits less hard, all sorts fixes we've talked about. But you're saying that it goes beyond that, that it's actually the very sport itself that's problematic and we should just get rid of it?
No, it's more complicated than that, and I'm sorry. I know that we like to deal in kind of, that's part of football's appeal. It's very binary. There's you and the enemy. There's, you know, you win or you lose. But it's much more complicated. Here are things that are common sense measures that would make the sport less corrupt overnight. Revoke the NFL's nonprofit status. Require the allocation of public funds for sports facilities be approved by public referendum and make sure that the public, for any dollars they spend, sees a return on their investment. Enforce a weight limit on players or teams so that the incentive is set up for players to play at their natural weight rather than bulking up so that you don't have high school players who are 305 pounds, bigger than the pros were even 10 or 20 years ago. That's because there's been this arms race, and as the players get bigger and stronger and faster, mass times acceleration, they hit each other with more force and the game is more dangerous and their health is compromised. Create a helmet that records subconcussive hits so that the inducement is there for coaches to say, you better not lead with your helmet. If they don't have the moral gumption to say, because it's bad for you as a human being and 20 years down the line you might not be able to remember how to take your kid to her soccer practice, at least because the incentive is there to say, if you get to a certain number of G's, I have to actually put you on the bench, and that hurts my ability to win the game. You know, create incentives that force coaches a 3.0 GPA for any player that wants to play football. Then the coach has to say, look, you must do well in your classes or you don't have the privilege of playing this game. It's not because they want to necessarily, but because you create incentives that are in the right direction. But the larger thing that the book is trying to do is not to solve something. It's to say, we need to face what we're doing here when we watch football, when we consume football, because we're the ones in charge. I want readers to be in a state of distress and contemplation, not here's the answer.
But don't you think we all know this because we've heard the news stories and yet we're in willful denial? We set this aside on Sunday afternoon so that we can enjoy the game even though we know what's happening?
Here's what I think, Madeline. I think moral progress is inconvenient, and I also think it's possible. And I think America's the greatest country on the face of the earth, and we abolished the sin of slavery upon which this country was founded, and we gave women the vote. It's atrocious, the idea that was ever not a reality. And we managed to, or are managing to, we passed civil rights and are even trying to enforce it in most of the country. And we have gradually evolved, and that moral progress has been inconvenient, and it destabilizes the status quo. I think that we're at a moral crossroads when it comes to this particular form of entertainment, which, to repeat, I love the game. I am sorry every moment that I'm not sitting in front of a game with my pal Sean, like unwinding from the pressures of my life. But it's also true that when you're an adult at a certain point, and certainly being a parent is part of it, you just have to tough it out and say, you know what, I cannot do one thing and then try to teach my kids something else.
Steve Almond, his new book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve Almond, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Okay, were his arguments convincing to you? We'd love to hear from you. If you are a football fan and you heard that interview and you thought, what? Let us know. Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, our Friday film segment, Alonzo Duralde and Dave White discuss the high-minded offerings at the various film festivals, and they'll talk about the worst movie they've seen in a very long time.
This is a movie that is supposed to be about, you know, the raw sexual power of rock and roll, but it's also a Christian movie.
It's a Christian movie.
So all the rock and roll sounds like one of those golden oldies stage shows at Knott's Berry Farm.
Friday movies after a news update with Eric Roy.
listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs, continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Now, we usually reserve this space to talk about what's new in movie theaters for the weekend, but this week we're going to talk about what's new on the festival circuit. The Toronto International Film Festival kicked off yesterday, Telluride wrapped up on Monday, and curtains close on Venice tomorrow. Alonzo Duralde is chief film critic for The Wrap. Welcome.
Hello.
And Dave White is film critic for Movies.com. Hello.
Howdy.
And together they host the Linoleum Knife podcast. So, Alonzo, you went to Venice.
I did.
And there was one film in particular that got a lot of buzz. It's called Birdman.
Yeah.
And it stars Michael Keaton. Tell us about it.
It was the opening night film. It's the latest from Alejandro González Iñárritu, who previously did such bummer fests as Beautiful and Babel and 21 Grams. Turns out he has a sense of humor. This movie is actually really funny in a dark sort of way. It's shot by Emmanuel Lubezki, who just won an Oscar for Gravity, which is worth mentioning because the film is structured to look like it's one uninterrupted take. Although it's not, they use, you know, camera tricks and editing to pull it off. But it gives the movie a certain kind of manic energy, and it sort of matches the jitteriness of the characters. Michael Keaton plays a character, an actor, who has been typecast as a superhero. Go figure. and he's now about to launch a Broadway show that he adapted, directed, and is starring in that's a stage version of Raymond Carver's What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. And all the last-minute disasters you would imagine in a Broadway show are happening, and he is hearing the voice of Birdman in his head telling him to, you know, knock it off with the artsy fartsy stage stuff and go back to making the apocalyptic pornography his fans want to see. And this is a really smart movie, and it's unpredictable. The cast is great. It features Edward Norton playing a kind of annoyingly method actor, which sort of dovetails with what a lot of us think of Edward Norton. And also Emma Stone and Naomi Watts and Zach Galifianakis and Merritt Weaver. I liked it a lot, and I've not been a fan of González Iñárritu up till now.
Okay, let's hear a clip from the trailer.
We had it all. You were a movie star, remember?
Who was this guy? He used to be Birdman.
I like that poster.
You wrote this adaptation?
I did, yeah.
And you're directing and starring in your adaptation. That's ambitious.
Are you afraid people will say you're doing this play to battle the impression that you're a washed-up comic strip character?
Absolutely not. That's why 20 years ago I said no to Birdman 4.
Hold the mask off! You do hold the mask off!
You said you're not a fan of Iñárritu's
earlier
work. I'm not.
Until now, yeah.
And Dave?
No. Just his films, they make me feel like someone's stabbing my brain with a fork. I have not seen Birdman, and I will trust Alonzo Duralde on this for now, although normally I do not. Normally, no matter what he says about a movie, I just think, well, you're out of your gourd all the time, so I don't trust anything you say.
This is why you two are happily married.
That is correct. Okay. But his earlier films are torture, and not simply because the subject matter is dour. Like, I love a good bummer movie, but they feel like wallows to me, you know, where everything is just meant to be rubbed in your face. Beautiful. That was the latest one in particular. I remember the minute all of the illegal Chinese laborers showed up in Barcelona, I thought, they're all going to die somehow. Like, something's going to happen and they're all going to die. And boom, halfway through the movie, look, there are a room full of them. They're all dead.
Right. And that was just element of the misery.
And that's just
that movie.
One awful moment.
21 grams is what you weigh, is the weight of your soul.
Yeah.
Right?
I call them the Greasy Parka movies, where it's just, you know, it's one thing to sort of portray the misery of the poor and the working class or whatever. And then it's another thing to just, like you said, wallow in it and really just kind of overdo it and underline it and have these big unearned kind of
homilies. Don't you feel bad about all of this now?
Yeah,
what are you going to do about it?
But
nothing? Okay.
But you would never know that guy's making Birdman, because this movie has a real lightness to it, and it's fresh and it is sardonically funny, and it's a terrific movie. I very highly recommend it.
All right, another one that played in Venice, a documentary. It's called The Look of Silence, and it's a follow-up to the documentary that was critically acclaimed, an amazing documentary called The Act of Killing. And both of these are about the genocide in Indonesia in 1965, a million Indonesians killed in the space of 1 year.
Right. And I think The Look of Silence would be a more effective movie if The Act of Killing didn't exist. But because Act of Killing is such a it took a take that we really hadn't seen in kind of these historical tragedy documentaries, where he's basically talking to the evil victors and basically giving the executioners enough rope. He lets them tell their own stories and let them sort of gloat over their accomplishments, quote unquote. This movie feels a lot more standard. It's from the victim's point of view. It's still a powerful story, but it's the exact same story that we heard in the previous film. And it's told in a way that doesn't feel as interesting. And I think that, you know, if this were the first one out of the gate, absolutely, you know, it would be undeniably powerful. But given that it's the Act of Killing guy, it's sort of like, okay, you've made this movie and you made it better.
All right, let's move on to a movie that got a lot of headlines when it played at Telluride. And it's also going to be at Toronto. It's called The Imitation Game, and it stars Benedict Cumberbatch.
Gentlemen, meet Mr. Turing.
We to work together, then. I'm afraid these men would only slow me down.
Popular at school, were you?
We're short on staff.
We get more staff, then. You have 6 minutes to complete the task.
Is it even possible?
No, it takes me 8.
5 minutes and 34 seconds.
You said to do it in under 6. What is it that we're really doing?
We're going to break an unbreakable Nazi code and win the war.
Oh.
Okay, so this is a biopic. It tells the story of the code breaker during World War II, Alan Turing, also the father of computer science, and also had an incredible life story. And Dave, what can you tell us about that movie?
Another bummer. And that is, unfortunately, you know, the history of gay people in public up until the recent past has been one where they are
hounded,
you know, hounded, persecuted, imprisoned, tortured, killed, you know. And those are all things that happened to Alan Turing. And so after he, you know, was the hero of World War II, they chemically castrated him. Mm-hmm. Did he spend time in prison?
I think he served some jail time, eventually committed suicide. And yeah, I mean, he's one of the great heroes of the 20th century. But because he was gay, he was hounded and lived a life
and
of misery.
And
so it's about time that he gets a biopic, basically. There's a Derek Jacobi played him in a 90s TV movie called Breaking the Code, which is based on a play that I was actually in once in Dallas years ago. So Alan Turing's a hero of mine and of a lot of people.
To be an actor.
Yeah, and it was about 2 seconds. But anyway, I'm very much looking forward to this movie because I Turing is a great historical figure, and more people should know who he is.
Okay. Lots of other festival premieres to talk about, but we only have room for so much, so let's prioritize. There are two, not one, but two Adam Sandler films playing at Toronto this year. So in honor of that, let's go back in time and listen to a little clip from Billy Madison.
Shampoo is better. I go on first and clean the hair. Conditioner is better. I leave the hair silky and smooth. Oh, really, fool, really.
You love it. Dave loves it.
I love
that
stuff.
He's playing with his shampoo conditioner bottle.
He's the worst. But those 90s, early 90s Adam Sandler movies, I laugh knowing that everything that I'm laughing at is absolutely wrong. And sometimes he gets me like that. Like, I can be watching an Adam Sandler movie, the worst Adam Sandler
Dave
movie.
Has defended That's My Boy on record.
You're using the word defended. Not defended. Enjoyed.
Totally different. You should still be ashamed of yourself.
Totally different. There's something about him sometimes that catches me in spite of knowing better.
So is that the secret to his appeal, why he is
No, I think a lot of people who like his movies are just dumb.
But no, I will say this. He's in the new Jason Reitman movie, and I'm not sure what his other Toronto film is. But, you know, people like us who are not, or people like me who do not like the comedies, you know.
Yes, you are pure. You've never liked a single thing he's ever done, except for Funny People and Punch Drunk.
Exactly. So, yeah, I want to see him making more movies like that.
Yeah.
And fewer Grown Ups 2s. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. No Happy Gilmore?
No Happy Gilmore 2. Yeah, yes. I think we'll leave well enough alone.
One is enough. All right.
Yes, Happy Gilmore.
All right. So, Dave, incorrigible.
Let's talk about movies actually people can see this weekend. Two musicals are out this weekend. One is called God Help the Girl, and this is a movie written and directed by Stuart Murdoch, also known as the frontman for Belle and Sebastian. So what'd you think?
It is a lovely, lovely movie. If you have a very low twee tolerance, you know, if you don't like seeing movies about indie rock boys in big glasses and girls who write lyrics and diaries, might not be your thing. But if you're willing to roll with that, I found this movie really charming. It's the kind of movie where people run through the streets of Glasgow passing out flyers to find guitarists for their band. You know,
it's very cute. Cute has its place.
Is there a plot?
Yeah. Emily Browning, who I now forgive for Sucker Punch after this movie because she's lovely in it.
It's never the actor's fault.
I know. You're right.
They're just working.
You're right. You're right.
She didn't make Sucker Punch be the worst thing in the world.
Okay. You're right. That's Zach's
fault. Unless it's Adam Sandler, then it is.
Yeah. Adam Sandler is steering the ship. Anyway, Emily Browning is very charming in this. She plays a troubled young girl who escapes from a hospital where she's been living and goes to Glasgow to become a musician. And falls in with this, you know, the aforementioned big glasses indie rock boy. And, you know, it's the kind of movie where everyone's young and adorable and they've all got at least two potential love interests and they sing a lot. And I'm down for that.
Okay, so let's hear a little clip of it.
So, is the band going to have a name?
Oh, no. Not a name conversation.
Why not a name conversation?
Don't you think it's stupid just to give yourself a name just because you sing songs?
What, so the Beatles were stupid?
Well, they were kind of stupid if they actually stopped to think about it.
Okay, so that's from God Help the Girl. Finally, a movie that's not getting a lot of praise, also a musical, The Identical.
Oh, wow. Film critics have to see a lot of run-of-the-mill bad movies.
I can't even talk about this movie
without
cracking
every
up.
So often you get a historically Looney Tunes bad movie, the kind that you call all your friends and say, no, really, you got to go see this
right now. Is
this like
a Showgirls of movies?
Well, Dave will tell you Showgirls is actually a good movie, but that's a conversation
that's
for another day.
Conversation.
Yeah, no, this is one of the, I've been calling this Oogie Loves for Grown-Ups. It is so
pretty much
unhinged and wrong and misguided and just...
It is about...
What is, yes, thank you.
It is about a young man who was given up for adoption. He has an identical twin.
Hence the title.
His identical twin grows up to be an Elvis-like figure named Drexel Hemsley.
Really?
And the guy the movie's actually about, the identical twin, grows up to be a mechanic and then a Drexel Hemsley impersonator and never seems to quite understand that he is the identical twin of Drexel Hemsley. It gets better. This is a universe in which Elvis Presley also exists, but his cultural influence is dwarfed by Drexel Hemsley and all of Drexel Hemsley's Hawaii movies and all of Drexel Hemsley's terrible, terrible, originally written for the film, songs. And even weirder, neither Elvis Presley nor Drexel Hemsley invented rock and roll, but the mechanic and Drexel Hemsley impersonator invented rock and roll with a song titled Boogie Woogie Rock and Roll, which is a song that will pour gasoline on your nightmares for nights to come.
This is a movie that is supposed to be about, you know, the raw sexual power of rock and roll, but it's also a Christian movie.
It's a Christian movie.
So all the rock and roll sounds like one of those golden oldies stage shows at Knott's Berry Farm.
It's a Christian movie that will make you feel sorry for Christianity. Like, what did Jesus do to deserve this film?
And then on top
of it... It doesn't even make itself be a Christian movie.
It's also...
Most of the film.
It's also... They keep trying to make it about, like, Jews and Christians together. So Ray Liotta is a 1930s fundamentalist preacher in Alabama preaching about how Jews and Christians are equal. Because that happened with Pentecostal preachers in 1930s Alabama. And then later... The movie talks more about the Six-Day War than it does about Vietnam.
It doesn't discuss Vietnam at all. It has this bizarre fixation with Israel's Six-Day War. It takes place
from the 30s to the 70s.
40 years, yeah.
Oh.
It stars a guy named
Blake Rain,
who is a former Elvis impersonator. He is like the Uncanny Valley Elvis, where he looks kind of like Elvis and he sounds kind of like Elvis, and you wonder why in this film's universe people don't look at him and say, well, you really, you know, you kind of look and sound like Elvis.
And the poor guy has never acted before, and he has to carry this whole movie and play two characters, and it's...
Yeah. It's a special kind of bad film, is the kind where every new scene and every line of dialogue is the opportunity for the film to make the worst, wildest possible wrong choice. This is obviously someone's vision, you know, someone's very personal
labor
vision.
Of love.
It's getting a wide release, which is strange. Like, they normally don't wide release faith-based films like this. But boy, is it worth your time. If you are if you're down, this is your movie.
Bad movie fans need to cancel their plans for the weekend and go see The Identical.
You won't know what hit you. It is flabbergasting.
Wow. Okay, this is a great way to end after we started on the high note of all the festivals and all that. Amazing fare there. All right. Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap, Dave White, film critic for movies.com, and together they host the amazing podcast, The Linoleum Knife. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you.
And coming up on Press Play, we will remember Joan Rivers with the director of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Legendary comedian Joan Rivers died yesterday. She was 81. She was the child of Russian immigrants and a pioneer for women in show business. She was the only woman to ever host a late-night network talk show.
These are all my jokes. These are jokes over the last 30 years. These are just, every time I write a joke, I try to remember to get it on a card. Why should a woman cook? So her husband can say, my wife makes a delicious cake to some hooker. And you wonder why I'm still working at this age.
Joan Rivers was a tireless performer. She did her stand-up act in New York City just a day before she was hospitalized. She was funny and acerbic and a truth teller.
The minute you're not angry about things, the minute you're not upset about things, what are you talking about? Oh, my grandson was so cute. It's not my comedy. I'm furious about everything. Furious about everything. Good things don't always happen to good people. And I'm very angry about it. But if I didn't have the anger, I wouldn't be a comedian. Anger fuels a comedy.
For some of the same reasons that made her successful, Joan Rivers was also one of those lover or hater kind of people. But who was she really? The clips you just heard are from a 2010 documentary that tried to answer that question. It's called Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work, and Ricky Stern was co-director of the movie. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the notes for your film say Joan has already taken precautions in her will so that she will not be resuscitated if she cannot perform a 60-minute comedy set. And you spent a year with her, documenting her and her furious work habits. Did she ever stop working?
Oh, no. No, she was around the clock. And if she wasn't working, she was reading a new book or going to see a play. She just had a voracious appetite for.
So she was 76 years old when you were filming, and what could you determine was the driver behind that? What was it that pushed her to work constantly and not say, well, I'm old enough, I can now retire, I have enough money?
Yeah, I mean, she said on many times, like, oh, I have to work, I need the money. But really, I would say to her, Joan, what about selling a chair? You know, she had things. I don't think it was really just about the money. I think, you know, she loved and was passionate about performing. And many of the things she did on the side was to, you know, make enough money so that she could support all the people she supported and the generosity. She really was an incredibly generous person. that, but ultimately she loved doing her comedy act. You talked about, you know, she was in this small club, you know, recently. She would go to those small clubs once a week to perfect her act and try out new material and donate the proceeds from the show to her, one of her charities. And it really was about the love of being in front of an audience and making people laugh. And she loved her fans.
You open the film showing her getting her makeup put on, and it's a very close-up shot of her face, and it's not a young face, and she's putting her makeup on assiduously. And, of course, she's famous for all her plastic surgeries, and she talked a lot about that. What did you think was the reason for that? I mean, a lot of people criticized her for that relentless obsession with her appearance and how it transformed her. What did she reveal to you about that?
You know, it's interesting. I went into it wondering myself, like, well, what's that all about? I'm going to get the root of that. That's going to be fascinating. And, you know, all you had to do is ask her, "What? Why plastic surgery?" And she would just say, you know, if it makes you feel good, do it. I feel I look better when I do it. And she didn't, you know, despite what people think, she didn't have major facelifts one after the other. She had minor little things, you know, she used the Botox or whatever she would do. But that is, she just felt better about herself. And she wasn't someone to critic, even though I know in Fashion Police, you know, her job was to critique people. But in life, she wasn't someone to criticize. She was a very accepting person. She accepted all type people and all, you know, in the beginning, she was a supporter of gay rights before many people would come out and support gay rights. And that was just her thing. She takes in stray animals. You know, she, I think, envelops people who need a helping hand. And so, you know, for people to criticize her plastic surgery, I think, you know, her response is, well, if it makes you feel good, do it.
Hmm. And as we heard in the opening, she said she was furious about everything.
Yeah.
What was she furious about in particular?
You know, I think that fueled her comedy. I think when she got into that space, I think injustice and the pain of life and you know, that was the anger. But I think that is what she turned around and made funny. And in the film, there's a moment where she's talking about being deaf and someone was offended. And her response is, if we can't laugh together about tragic things, how are we going to get through it? You know, that was her form of medicine to take what others might shy away from and say, oh, we can't talk about that, and make a joke of it to make it possible to talk about things that were painful.
Well, right. And I think a lot of people, a lot of comics reacting to her death tried to respond in a way that they think she might have responded. Lena Dunham tweeted, "Joan is gone, but a piece of her lives on, her nose, because it's made of polyurethane." Do you think she would have, what do you think she would have felt about that? That kind of response
I
to
really,
her own death?
You know what? I really don't know. I mean, because, you know, I think on one level, yes, you know, I just know, knowing her, being around her, she wouldn't have wanted pity. You know, she, in the film, you know, it's like, forget it. She would deflect attention from her, and her way of deflecting was, let me talk about you. Let me ask you a question. You know, where are you from? What do you do? Oh, you have a girlfriend? Let me give you a scarf to give to your girlfriend. She was very much wanting to make others feel good. I know it sounds crazy when you think of her comedy, but really in life, that was the way she is. So I think she would want people to laugh, but that's just my opinion.
Did she like being the subject of your documentary?
Oh, you know, when I first asked Joan if she would do it, she was like, oh, sure, whatever, you know. And as I got to know her through the year, she, I saw, you know, that was the way she approached work. Like, you never know when something's going to hit. You got to just take everything and see what's going to stick. You know, you just got to do it. And that was her work ethic, and she worked really hard at it. And she had no patience for celebrities or people who, you know, got to a place and they weren't going to work hard or they weren't going to be generous to their fans. She knew what it took to get there, and she believed she would continue on. And through the film, I think she was always like, what are you guys doing? What is this going to be about? Like, isn't this boring? You know, like, just, okay, guys, you can film, but haven't you got enough? Isn't this boring? And, you know, when she saw it, her response was the same, put more dogs in it, and boring. My life is boring. You know, I'm always in the makeup chair. It's so boring. But other people didn't feel that way.
Well, Ricky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Ricky Stern, co-director of the documentary Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. And Julie Myers is here now to wrap up the week.
Yes, which was a real piece of work. We talked to Steve Allman about why he quit watching the NFL, even though he's always been a fan. Some of our listeners broadened out a bit to talk about the things they quit, even though they loved them anyway. Samit Mixer says he quit eating meat. Loves it, just doesn't work with his personal beliefs. And Padrome Adeli says he quit using major commercial banks after the credit default fiasco. It's far less convenient to deal with community banks, but it's totally worth it for his peace of mind. Today on the show, we also talked about Yelp and what happens when a business gets burned by a review that may or may not be real. Kristen called in with her thoughts.
So much what happens on Yelp could be alleviated or dealt with in a one-to-one communication between a customer and a business owner, and yet we don't do that anymore. It's much easier to go on Yelp and rip a business than having an honest face-to-face conversation with a manager of a business. And what that does is it allows us to air our dirty laundry with any business without really enabling that business to defend itself or to make it right.
But Dan called in to tell us it's not about the businesses, it's about consumers. And Yelp's a great place to find information that's useful to consumers.
All right, useful to consumers of Press Play, your commentary. Thank you, Julie Myers. Have a great weekend. We're in All Need to the Point up next. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, everyone. See you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane. The Kane Foundation is committed to enriching the cultural and civic life of Los Angeles. For over a decade, the Kane Foundation has made strategic grants to make Los Angeles a better place to live for future generations.